Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
The song is over. It's all behind me.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Anthony Brooks, and this is On Point. Roger Daltrey was 27 when he recorded this, pretty much at the top of his fame, but already the melancholy was creeping in. Today, long after his flowing blonde locks are gone, not to mention his ability to hit those high notes, this song still gets airplay on classic rock station and on lots of personal playlists. Daltrey of The Who also sang, "I hope I die before I get old." Well, no such luck. He's still with us. The song somehow still isn't over. This hour on Point, the long, long twilight of classic rock. You can join us on air or online. Why are so many of us still listening to The Who, The Stones, The Beatles, Led Zeppelin, and many more a half a century after they were making the music of now? What is it about the power and mythology of classic rock that still holds us? And what happens when all those classic rockers are gone? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. You can also join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And joining me now from St. Paul, Minnesota is Stephen Hayden. He's the cultural critic at the online culture journal UpRocks and host of the podcast Celebration Rock. His new book is called Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. You can read an excerpt on our website. Stephen Hayden, welcome to On Point. It's so great to have you, and I've been so looking forward to talking to you about this book. So thank you for coming in.
Well, I'm excited to talk about it with you.
Yeah, it's a really fun read. And I want to start with just a really basic question. What inspired you to write it? I mean, was it that so many of these great rock and rollers are leaving us? David Bowie, Prince, Tom Petty, Chuck Berry, Greg Allman, Leonard Cohen, to name just a few in the last year or two. Is that what sort of led you to say, hey, these guys are all going to be gone, I got to write about this before it's too late?
Yeah, I mean, I actually started thinking about this in 2012 when I went to go see The Who on the Quadrophenia tour. And of course, it wasn't exactly The Who. It was Roger Daltrey and Pete Townsend, because Janet Wessel and Keith Moon have long since departed. And obviously, I knew going into the show that these guys were in their late 60s. They were not the same people that recorded Who's Next, you know, 40-some years ago. Mm. But there was just something about that show. It was a very poignant experience for me, because I think it just drove home the idea that, you know, this might be the last time I see The Who.
Right.
You know, because these guys cannot keep doing this forever. So I started thinking about the idea at that time, and actually pitched an idea around then for the book. But I think it was like a little premature. It wasn't really on the front of mind for a lot of people. So flash forward to 2016, and we saw, you know, David Bowie passed away, Prince passed away. And there was just this series of high-profile rock stars who had died, and you just saw this outpouring of grief from the public, people not just mourning the stars, but in a way kind of mourning a part of their own past. And it just seemed like at that time, you know, the idea for a book like this, its time had come. So it was, I had the idea before then, but I think this is now something that I think we're all sort of grappling with.
Absolutely. I'd love it if you could read just a paragraph that comes early in your book, sort of about an act of faith. This is on page 12. Just, it says so much about your passion and love for classic rock. Would you mind reading that for us?
Loving classic rock has always been an act of faith. Albums as sacred texts, live concerts as quasi-religious rituals, and rock mythology as a means of self-discovery. After discovering classic rock at the dawn of middle school, I committed myself to studying rock scripture. I read all the books, subscribed to all the magazines, and watched all the documentaries. I sought out the most crucial LPs of the rock canon and played them over and over until the lyrics became my personal ethos. I loved the guitar riffs, the bombastic drums, the preening vocals. But what made classic rock an obsession for me was the belief that I was plugging into something profound and larger than life. I'm not a religious person, but if there is a God, I was sure I had found him on side two of Abbey Road.
It's fantastic. And of course, these guys, mostly, of course, these classic rock guys are not gods. And yet, you write really wonderfully about this. You sort of imbue them with a kind of mythology. I mean, that explains, in a way, their hold on us, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think one important thing to mention here is that I am not of the generation that grew up with these bands as they were young and putting out records. Like, I'm a member of Generation X. You know, I came to this music, you know, 20 years after the fact through classic rock radio and through reading books like Hammer of the Gods by Stephen Davis, you know, the Led Zeppelin book, or No One Here Gets Out Alive, you know, the book about Jim Morrison. So there was this layer of mythology that was really thick at that point. And it was something that really drew me in at that age. You know, like when you're a teenager, you know, some kids read comic books or they worship athletes. Like my comic book heroes were Robert Plant and Keith Richards and people like that. You know, people that were still around, but when I thought of them, they were the people that they were in the 60s and 70s. In a way, they were fictional characters in a way that I brought to life in my imagination. And I think that's a common experience for a lot of people who come to this music later on, people of Generation X, millennials, now even Generation Z. And the fact that these bands can still play arenas, I think, is due to people my age and younger. If it were just baby boomers that cared about these artists, you know, they would be playing casinos right now.
Right, there wouldn't be enough of us left to be there to fill up the casino, to fill up the big venues, I guess. Yeah,
right. And I think for people my age, that's a big deal.
Yeah, absolutely. I want to hear some music. Let's listen to a great band and a great song. This is "A Day in the Life" from the Beatles' Abbey Road.
Found my coat and grabbed my hat. Made the bus in seconds flat. Smoke, and somebody spoke, and I went into a dream.
Day in the Life of the Beatles, and of course that's off of Sgt. Pepper's, I misspoke going into that. I want to ask you, Stephen, about this song and about this band, because you've told the story about classic rock with a clean beginning and end, and you say it starts with the Beatles' Abbey Road, and it ends with Nine Inch Nails. Let's start with Abbey Road. Why is this the start?
Well, in talking about Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band being like sort of the beginning of the classic rock era, in terms of an album being taken seriously as like a high form of art, in the same way that you would talk about a novel or a great film or painting, you know, before that, you know, rock and roll was really talked about in terms of being teen music, you know, that this was music for kids, and it wasn't kind of given that level of seriousness. And the classic rock era, there is a very sort of chin-strokey aspect to it that I think gets introduced with that record, especially when you read rock criticism of that time. You know, there were a lot of music critics who weren't happy about that transition. You know, they didn't like the sort of entry of artistic pretension into the music. They liked the innocence of sort of the early rock and roll. And that's really kind of the beginning of like rock is dead type talk. You know, like people were talking about rock being dead already in the late 60s. Mm. And what they were talking about was that sort of death of the innocence that happened. And of course, we see recurrences of that narrative that, you know, they're still going on today, but that's kind of been part of rock history for, you know, 50 some years.
It seems like Sgt. Pepper's 2 was the first rock and roll album that really kind of lent itself to, what does it mean? What are they saying? I mean, it had that great cover, that double cover that you opened up and all of those faces. And I mean, I remember, I think I was 10 when that came out, and it represented such a change from the kind of She Loves You, Yeah, Yeah, Yeah of the Beatles. Suddenly they were deep and psychedelic and going places that weren't exactly clear, you know?
And I think it's also the idea that an album can capture the tenor of the times,
yeah.
You know, that the album is sort of the central artistic unit of rock music, and that we're going to talk about different eras or artists' careers in terms of the records that they put out. And I think Sgt. Pepper, you know, it was a record that the Beatles, they stopped touring to make that record. They were in the studio for, you know, six-some months, which was unprecedented for them. I mean, in the early part of the 60s, they were putting out albums every 6 months. And here they were, you know, sort of ensconcing themselves in the studio to make this masterful record that was a major statement. And whenever we have records like that in rock history, these sort of major statement records, we talk about them using a lot of the same language that people use to talk about Sgt. Pepper. Like, that record kind of helped invent the narrative of, like, the masterpiece, the era-defining masterwork in rock history.
Right. So classic rock history begins with Sgt. Pepper's. You say it ends with Nine Inch Nails.
Yeah. So, look, when you talk about classic rock, it's a very tricky thing because no one really knows what it is. Everyone defines it in different ways. Some people, when they say classic rock, they're really referring to it almost like as a qualitative statement. Like, this is the best classic rock.
Right.
Whereas some people associated only with the 60s and 70s. So it's a very specific time frame. In my book, I'm sort of inventing my own definition that's a hybrid of different definitions. And I know people are going to read this book and say, why is Nine Inch Nails in a classic rock book? And my rationale for that is that when you listen to classic rock radio now, you are now hearing 90s bands being integrated into that history because classic rock really started as a radio format that was invented to reach a certain demographic of people. Like, there's really no genre called classic rock.
Mm-hmm.
And so now you're hearing Nirvana and Pearl Jam and bands like Nine Inch Nails in there. The reason why I picked The Fragile, though, is that that record, it came out at a time when a couple of things were happening. One, Napster really took a hold of how music was being distributed. And Napster is sort of the beginning of albums starting to be broken down and not being the central way that we consume music. So it's an ending point in that way for rock music. And also, it was the beginning of, like, the internet being the hub of how we get together. It wasn't the rock show anymore. The Fragile really kind of signaled the beginning of the end for a lot of things.
I like what you wrote, too, in the book, defining a classic rock. If you sold millions of albums, played arenas, and benefited from a major record label, paying disc jockeys with cocaine and microwaves in order to get your music on the radio, you were classic rock. I love that. Listen, we're going to take a break, and we're going to talk about a lot more. We're talking about classic rock, why it still gets play even as those old rockers age and die. You can join the conversation. What explains the longevity of this music? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. We're at 1-800-423-TALK. We'll go out with The Fragile by Nine Inch Nails. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point. But it's too late for me.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
The news can feel like an echo chamber. You listen to podcasts to get that perspective shift. So travel with NPR's Rough Translation. Follow familiar conversations in unfamiliar parts of the world and get a new perspective on home. Rough Translation. Find it wherever you get your podcasts. How does it feel?
On Point, I'm Anthony Brooks, and does this song even need an introduction? Let's just say that it was released in 1965, and it's still talking so loud and seeming so proud. My guest is cultural critic Stephen Hayden. His new book is called Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. You can join the conversation. Why does this music still attract fans long after boomers cut their hair and got a job? Millennials, And by the way, Stephen Hyden's a millennial. Do you have these songs on your playlist? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Stephen, I want to talk a little bit about Bob Dylan, who we're listening to in the background. He comes up a lot in your book. Does he stand atop your pantheon of classic rock gods?
Yeah, it would be him and, you know, Springsteen. Like, they're two of the biggest characters in the book. Dylan was definitely crucial for me growing up because he was someone that I didn't really get for a long time. Like, I was reading a lot of rock criticism as a teenager, so I was aware of how important he was. But it was one of those things, like, where I had to keep listening to him to get it, you know, because the voice was a turnoff, the lyrics were so obtuse and dense. And then there was just a moment where it all clicked for me. And really, what was a big, I think, skeleton key with me and Bob Dylan was that Royal Albert Hall bootleg when he was on tour with the Hawks in 1966, his first electric tour, where he was playing to hostile crowds and he's getting booed between every song. And, you know, someone calls him Judas at the end of the show, like, before playing like a Rolling Stone. And I think, like, as a kid who was growing up with, like, grunge rock in the 90s and loved Nirvana and Pearl Jam and all those bands, that in a way that was a Dylan that I could connect to more readily. You know, there was an anger in that era of Dylan that really responded, that really made me respond. And after that, I just became totally obsessed.
Interesting about Dylan, isn't it? About, I mean, the fact that he's remade himself so many times that he's sort of given people in different generations different points of entry. I mean, because I sort of lived it the same way that you did. I didn't get it. And then I'm older than you. Then Nashville Skyline came along and it's like, oh, wow, I get it. And then a few years later, Blood on the Track was like, oh, I really get it. But now he's doing something completely different. So he keeps giving these different portals into his art to different generations, it seems.
And I think what's amazing about him, too, is that, you know, specific songs go through so many different transitions. Like, in my Dylan chapter, I read about the song Visions of Johanna, which is my favorite Dylan song. It's originally on Blonde on Blonde. And I write about all the different versions of that song. If you listen to Dylan bootlegs from, you know, the past 50 years, you know, he plays that song differently, you know, in every era, in every tour. And the song changes with him. Like, there's some versions that are really, you know, sort of brash and, you know, rocking. And then there's other versions, you know, like from the mid-70s when he's going through a divorce where it's really heartbroken. And other versions where, you know, you can see him almost dealing with middle age, you know, when he's playing the song. There's sort of like a middle-age melancholy that's imbued into the music. So there really is that with Dylan, like, where if you invest yourself into it, you get so much back.
Yeah.
You know, the more you put into it, the more you get back, I think.
Listeners, we're talking to Stephen Hyden. His book is Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Sal, calling from Medford, Massachusetts. Sal, great that you called. Thanks a lot. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Anthony. Great guest. Great show. I am a musician, and your guest history sounds a lot like my own in terms of how I got into rock and roll, but just the education of rock and roll. And I just wanted to say that I perform still after 30 years, and I'm in a group that performs classic rock. And the reason I take just slight issue with the premise is that I feel like, you know, one of the key elements to what we do is like this idea that it is art. And like Mozart, Bach, Beethoven, or the pinnacle of an art form like Swan Lake or Van Gogh, it's just everybody who hears it, and you mentioned Abbey Road, that's a perfect example. Everybody who hears that music understands that it's the seed from which everything else kind of sprung. And so when we perform, and we don't do it as a, you know, nobody's up there in a Freddie Mercury mustache, we're just playing the music. What we find from the audience is that, you know, they're so grateful to be able to hear this music in three dimensions and not just from their stereo.
It's a great point that you're making. Let me get Stephen Hyden to respond.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything he just said. I mean, there's obviously, this music wouldn't still be popular if the music itself wasn't great, you know, and I write a lot about just loving this music. I think one of the reasons it also endures, and this kind of connects back to the sort of quasi-religious aspect of that passage I read earlier, but I really connected with the continuum of music when I was a kid. And I think one of the things that drew me to classic rock was what, you know, what the caller was just mentioning, this idea of like, well, this is like the wellspring that things come from, that you can listen to music now and you can connect it to something that existed 50 years ago. And of course, the Beatles, you know, they have their own precursors, and you can research that and you can go to that, and then those precursors have their precursors. And I just find that kind of a beautiful thing, you know, that idea that you can connect with something that existed long before you were born, that I can listen to like Robert Johnson and hear a voice on a recording and I can relate to that, even though he died 40 years before I was born. And to me, that is a sort of beautiful spiritual thing. It's like how that's the way that you commune with the dead, you know, or with spirits, you know. So that's a big theme in my book, you know, that idea.
I want to play another song and then talk about it. So let's listen to this.
You're out on the streets looking good, and baby, deep down in your heart, I guess you know that it ain't right. Never, 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 never heal me when I cry. Baby, I cry all the time, but each time I tell myself that I can't stand the pain. But when you hold me in your arms, I sing it once again. Sit, come on, come on, come on, come on. Yeah, take another little piece of my heart now, baby.
Janis Joplin, of course, doing A Piece of My Heart. Stephen, I wanted to play some Janis Joplin because I love her, and also as a kind of exceptional counterpoint to your point that classic rock was dominated by white guys, white men, and of course it was. But also I wanted to ask you about Janis Joplin as part of this group of rock and rollers who left us too young. You know, Jimi Hendrix, Jim Morrison, among others. And isn't that part of what defines this mythology around classic rock, the sort of dangerousness of it? I mean, Keith Richards didn't succumb, but in a way he should have, and that's always a reminder of just how sort of dangerous and thrilling this music can be.
Yeah, I mean, I think the idea of the martyr, you know, became a big thing early on, this idea that you are creating this body of work that is small, but it's incredibly vital, and then you end up leaving the earth, and then but your music continues to inspire people after the fact. Yeah. And that's a very romantic idea. There's a lot of problematic behavior that's been excused because of that romantic idea. I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is, you know, sort of the decadence of classic rock, and how that was one of the things for me, like growing up, that drew me to it. You know, the sort of sex, drugs, and rock and roll romantic idea, and how that's a real big part of it, and also how that's become sort of anachronistic, I think, in a lot of ways. You know, like when we look back on that stuff, you know, I think especially now, you know, it's not glamorized to the same degree, and I think that's a good thing. And one of the things I think that my book tries to do is talk about that in a way that is honest about how appealing it was, I think, for a lot of people, but also taking stock of the damage that that does and how it's a good thing that we've moved past that. And why I think sometimes when we talk about where classic rock is in the culture overall, that's like one of the things that people talk about, along with this sort of like white male Superman myth that was very predominant in classic rock history and was sort of reinforced by, you know, the tastemakers of the time, you know, what people chose to write about, and how female artists were often locked out of being taken as seriously as their male counterparts. It's really only the last like 10, 15 years where people have sort of done the work of revising the canon and saying, no, these people deserve to be in here too. I mean, it also happens with how we categorize music.
Yeah.
That there's a lot of artists who, you know, could have been put under the classic rock 10, who could have been played on classic rock radio, and they weren't because of the color of their skin. They were reclassified as R&B or soul or funk or whatever. That's something that's also being dismantled as well, you know, in recent years.
Stephen, let's take some more calls. Jeff is calling from Norfolk, Virginia. Jeff, it's good to have you. Thanks for the call. You're on the air.
Hi, Anthony. Thanks. I'm a music journalist here in Norfolk, and I love the conversation. I want to say, you know, for the baby boomer generation coming up, rock stars were heroes to that generation at a very critical time, not only coming of age of teenagers and being in their early 20s, but all the social change going on in Europe and America. FM radio was also coming of age, so you had that album-oriented rock format, which was perfect for classic rock artists. You mentioned Sgt. Pepper's. You know, that was an album that had no singles released from it. Todd Rundgren once told me that was the very first concept album, where the album was a work of songs, and each song was like a chapter in the book, and you had a complete work. I want to say also that the longevity of classic rock being popular is due to these musicians still being on the road touring, but also the quality of the songwriting, the quality of the musicianship, and the characters. Many of these classic rock artists, you know, you could distinguish who is who. And I would say the classic rock died in the early 1990s when grunge came about, and classic rock formatted. They were just rock stations at the time, commercial rock stations. They put the brakes, and they defined anything that happened before 1991, 92 was going to be labeled and branded classic rock, and then it made room for modern rock. So if you were
Jeff, you've put a lot on the table, and I want to jump in because I want to get Stephen. One of the things I wanted to talk to you about, Stephen, that Jeff brought up really eloquently is the role of radio. And you write about this really well. And you write, you know, it was just so evocative. Radio is how I learned about classic rock. DJs told you which bands mattered. Can you describe the importance of the role of radio in classic rock's history and, you know, what has replaced it, if anything? I mean, who are the tastemakers today, if not FM radio?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think it can be overstated. I mean, again, like classic rock as a term was invented by radio programmers. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was this idea that, like, we are going to codify this generation of bands as, you know, as this thing, and we're going to play these bands over and over again. You know, the idea that I think before that, if you were going to be on the radio, you needed to have hits. You know, and as soon as you didn't have hits, you weren't going to be on the radio anymore. And with classic rock radio, it introduced this idea that, like, you could just have the same songs played over and over again. And, you know, as much as I love classic rock, and I think this music deserves to be heard and deserves to endure, I don't think you can really underplay the significance of this music being played all the time for many different generations, and that's why it's continued. You know, you've put the fact that you can still hear Hotel California, you know, mm-hmm. several times a day in any, you know, major market in this country, you know, that has a big effect on, you know, subsequent generations getting introduced to that music. Now, you know, now we're in a situation where a lot of younger listeners are hearing about music in different ways. You know, they're going on Spotify, they're going on the internet. They're not necessarily listening to the radio. But at the same time, in a way, it's easier now than it was when I was young to get into this era of music. You know, like when I was a kid, if I wanted to buy a Led Zeppelin tape, I had to ride my bike to like the only record store in town, and it was like an epic journey. You know, it was like an hour long trip
right.
to buy one tape.
Right now, everything is right there. Everything.
Exactly.
What riches. Yeah.
You can become a Led Zeppelin expert in the space of a day or two. You just read the Wikipedia entry and you listen to every record on Spotify. And that's why, you know, like there's this one band that it's like a pretty big band now. They're called Greta Van Fleet, and they're from Michigan, and they're all kids in their late teens and early 20s. And they're like one of the big kind of emerging rock bands right now. And they sound exactly like Led Zeppelin. Like, I can't overstate how much they sound like Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
And these kids were born, you know, around the year 2000, you know. And so I think that speaks to how there's still this generation of kids who is attracted to that era. You know, you go to any head shop in any city in the country, and the posters on the walls are still Led Zeppelin posters. They're still Pink Floyd posters. They're still Doors posters. So that kind of youth culture still exists for kids that want to be a part of it.
Stephen, I want to get another call in. Iris is calling from Maiden, North Carolina. Go ahead, Iris. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to comment about the generational gap that this music spans. And similar to the conversation you're just having about radio, I would ride in the back of my car with my parents and listen to what would have been the oldie station and a little bit of a classic rock station. And, you know, hear the songs from their high school and middle school experience, which kind of skewed 70s. But they saw the Eagles. They saw Elton John, you know. And my dad would play this game with me, and still does, where the song that's on, I have to be able to know the name of the song and the artist. And so, you know, I just grew up with a lot of this music kind of being encoded in my DNA. And so went to the public library when I was a kid and found Linda McCartney's 60s photo journal and just, you know, pored over it, like similar to what your author is speaking about, the kind of the comic book heroes. So now, you know, I'm kind of doing the same thing with my kids, and, you know, they're going to be the only kids who know who Three Dog Night is, probably, you know. But
well, they're going to be other kids as well, because lots of us baby boomers have kids, and we're doing the same thing. Stephen, what do you think? I love the way Iris talks about encoding this music in kids' DNA.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's absolutely right. I think a lot of people have that experience, and it's something that, you know, connected them to their parents, and they love the songs, but there's also the memories that become a part of that.
All right. Stephen, we got to take a break. We're going to listen to David Bowie's TVC 15 from the 1976 album Station to Station. When we come back, will classic rock and roll still matter long after these guys are all gone? Will the mythology live on? Give us a call. We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Anthony Brooks. This is On Point.
Hey, it's Guy Raz here, host of How I Built This. And on our latest episode, how Chip Wilson turned workout clothes into a fashion statement. And along the way, built a breakout brand, Lululemon, now worth billions. You can listen to How I Built This on Apple Podcasts or however you get your podcasts.
Driving that train.
This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're talking about the long afterlife of classic rock. You can join the conversation when the obituaries for Dylan, Jagger, and the forever young Springsteen have been written. Will the music still be with us? Give us a call, 1-800-423-8255. Listening now to the Grateful Dead, Casey Jones. My guest is Stephen Hayden, author of Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. And we're taking your calls at 1-800-423-8255. So let's go right back to the phones. Jim is calling from Nashville. Jim, good to have you. Go ahead. You're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Anthony. It's great to be with you. I had the opportunity to go to the Fairly Well show, the last Grateful Dead show at Soldier Field in July of 2016. And then I had an opportunity to go see Dead and Company play when they came to Nashville with John Mayer sitting in place of Jerry Garcia. And I just wanted to comment on the power of music and melody. And before I went to see Dead and Company, after the final Grateful Dead show at Soldier Field, I called my son who had seen them play, and I said, "Should I do this? Is it going to spoil the memory of that capstone event?" And he said, "No, you should go." And it was remarkable. And I came away with a real appreciation for it. It's the power of the songs. It's the melody and the message combined in that community setting. And it was, you know, it's very visceral. The melody makes it visceral, and the message makes it emotional.
Jim, I'm so glad you called and reminded us about Dead and Company. And of course, I want to correct what I said. I identified that song as a Grateful Dead. It is Dead and Company with John Mayer subbing in for the long deceased Jerry Garcia. And I want to ask you about that, Stephen Hayden, because you write about how a lot of these bands have adapted and sort of carried on, even though one or two in some cases more of their original players are no longer with us.
Yeah, I mean, the phenomenon I call it shrunk groups, you know, which is a play on supergroups, you know, which was a big thing in the 70s. This idea that as these classic rock bands are aging, in a way they're almost like melting together. And Dead & Company is an example of that, where, you know, John Mayer is hired to tour with the Rhythm Section and Bob Weir from the Grateful Dead. And going into it, you sort of look at it and you're like, John Mayer with the Grateful Dead? It doesn't really seem to make any sense. And yet they've been touring like this for a couple years now. And it's been amazing to see how the Dead community has embraced it. Hmm. You know, in my book, I write about seeing AC/DC in early 2016 when Brian Johnson was still their lead singer. And a couple weeks after that, Brian Johnson had to quit the road because his doctor said he was going to go deaf if he kept performing. So then AC/DC hired Axl Rose to be the new lead singer, which is not anything I could have ever predicted when I started writing this book. You know, I think, you know, as the caller was talking about, it does testify to the power of the music. I think it also is about the power of the experience,
yeah,
especially with a band like the Grateful Dead. I think people love the community that was built up around that band, and they love the experience of going to these shows, being around other fans, hearing this music in a big arena and singing along with other people and dancing. And I think people, even if they love Jerry Garcia and they may feel that the band isn't the same without him, they don't want to lose that experience. So it's like, well, this band sounds pretty good. It's not the original article, but it's a good sort of facsimile of that.
Right. It's as close as we're going to get. Right.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it still allows me to have this sort of, you know, communal experience that has always been a part of being a fan of that band.
Yeah. Well, speaking of aging rock stars, I want to play a clip from the Netflix comedy special Too Real with Marc Maron. In the midst of that movie, he goes on a sort of 10-minute riff on what it's like to go to a Rolling Stones concert as a middle-aged man. It's very funny. He's describing a moment where lead singer Mick Jagger is on the stage alone singing Moonlight Mile. He says Jagger is pulling it off. He's doing a good job when all of a sudden the camera zooms in tight on Jagger's face. Here's what he says.
They got the big screen, and they go right in on Mick's face. And there it is, 50 feet big. And I'm like, oh, God, why are you doing that to Mick? You could see everything, all the lines and the dyed hair. I'm like, dude, stop it, take it down. And it was sad. I was like, this is so horrible. Why are they doing that? And I just kept looking at him. And all of a sudden, it like, just hit me. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. This is amazing. It's a lot riskier for those guys to be doing this now than it was in 1972.
Marc Maron there from Too Real. Stephen Hyden, what about that? I mean, these guys are carrying on, you know, into their 70s. I know you still go to classic rock concerts when any opportunity that you have to go, but there's Marc Maron sort of having some fun with this, but they're still pulling it off in a lot of ways, right?
Yeah, I mean, and he's writing about an experience that's very similar to what I write about in the first chapter of the book when I went to that Who concert,
right,
which was sort of like the eureka moment for me. And, you know, I think it can be shocking sometimes to go to these shows because, again, you can know mentally that your heroes have gotten older. But there's like an act of imagination, I think, in a way, with loving this kind of music where because these bands have been frozen in ember for a long time, in a way, on classic rock radio or in your own record collection. You know, like, you stare at the album covers, you listen to the records that they made in their prime, and it's almost like they still exist as they were then. And then you go to a show and you realize that the passage of time has incurred. That said, a lot of classic rock shows I've gone to have been great, and they still play really well. You're at a moment now where I think a lot of these artists feel like they're maybe towards the end of their career, so they're not necessarily interested in flogging a new studio album that they know people aren't going to care about. Like, they kind of focus on, like, let's perform the best of our music, like, to the highest of our ability. Like, I saw Roger Waters last summer during his big arena tour, and he played some new songs off of a recent studio record, but he was basically playing Pink Floyd music. And he has an incredible band, and most of his band, you know, most of those people are like in their 30s and 40s. It's like young people that, you know, had Dark Side of the Moon posters on their wall, and now they get to play it with them. And it's like a really kind of young and hungry band that is behind him, and it gives the music, I think, a little bit extra oomph. for that reason. You know, and look, you can always like make fun of bands who get older, who continue the tour and all that stuff. But the fact of the matter is that like there's going to be a time when you can't see them.
Right.
You know, like Paul McCartney to me is like the closest thing that we have in the modern era to like a Mozart, you know. And it's like if you knew Mozart was playing a show in your town, like aren't you going to go see him?
Or, you know, I completely agree with you. Having never seen the Beatles, I keep saying to myself, I got to go see Paul McCartney before real-time contact with the Beatle is no longer a possibility. I think you make a great point.
Well, and he's still playing like three-hour shows, and yeah. He cares. You can tell that he cares when he's up there.
Okay, speaking of great classic rock shows and speaking of a guy who's still playing three-hour shows, let's listen to this.
I was raised out of steel here in the swamps of Jersey. Some misty years ago, through the mud and the beer and the blood and the cheers, I've seen champions come and go. So if you got the guts, mister, yeah, if you got the balls, if you think it's your time, then step to the line and bring on your wrecking ball. Bring on your wrecking ball.
Bruce Springsteen, of course. Stephen Hyden, I'd love to talk to you about Bruce Springsteen because, you know, in contrast to the way Mark Morin was making fun of Mick Jagger, I saw Springsteen just in the last couple of years at Fenway Park. I mean, this guy leaves it all on the stage. There's nothing old about him, even though, what, he's 68? I think I have that right.
He might almost be 70 at this point. I mean, yeah. Bruce Springsteen, it's hard for me to talk about Bruce without totally going over the top and being hyperbolic and maybe even starting to cry a little bit, because I think with a lot of people with him, you know, a lot of these classic rock heroes that we're talking about, they were reluctant heroes. You know, like Bob Dylan did not want to be put on a pedestal. Bruce Springsteen, in contrast, has always sort of embraced that hero aspect of being a rock star, and he's lived up to it. And you can see, like, he's the person that I feel like you look at him and he still looks indestructible. Like he needs is like the S on his chest and the cape. You know, there's something very deliberate about that, I think, with him, that sort of larger than life thing, and kind of embracing it while at the same time writing these great, intensely personal, intimate songs. And, I've seen him, too. I saw Springsteen on Broadway, and I thought it was incredible. Hmm. You know, and he's someone that I hope keeps making records for the next 20 years. You know, it's hard for me to imagine him not touring.
I'm with you.
You know, not doing it.
Let's go to Katie, who's calling from Simsbury, Connecticut. Katie, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi, Anthony. Thank you. I had so many thoughts, but now that you have Bruce on, I just have to say, he is still sexy. That's something that ties me to him still. But my original thought was related to the longevity of classic music, and that is being in the same generation, I think, as your guest. It ties me to my parents' generation, and it will always live because of that. And once we, in this generation, we start losing our parents, just the memories flood in every time I hear a song that I listened to with my father. You know, like we would lay in the dark and in pitch black with headphones on and really loud music, and my dad would tap the drums on his chest, and like, you know, he's passed on now, but I mean, the memories and the imagination, like you said, imagination is part of this. Imagining him sitting around the campfire, the stories I've heard, you know, drinking with his friends in the 70s and listening to an album from start to finish. And, you know, that was how they spent their Saturday night. They would get the album home and listen to it from start to finish. And the appreciation of music and quality music.
Katie, you've got such great recollections, and I love the appreciation of what it meant to bring an album home for the first time. Stephen, you spend some time later in the book talking about this idea that rock and roll is dead. you make the point that it's not, even though the old rockers will die off eventually, but you say rock and roll will continue to matter. Can you say a little bit more about that?
Well, you know, I was just thinking about what your caller was saying about how she said it connects her to her parents when she listens to this music. And, like, the way I prefer to think of this, I prefer to think of rock and roll as, like, a form of folk music. You know, like Dylan and Springsteen, they were both acolytes of Woody Guthrie. And the folk music tradition, it's an oral tradition. It's a tradition of passing music down. It's almost, I guess, the antithesis of pop music, which is very of the moment and ephemeral. And the idea of folk music is that these are songs that mean something that you hand down from generation to generation. And it's sort of, there's a sense of continuity to it, or the continuum, again, that I was talking about. And I think of that with rock and roll. Because, like, when you talk to rock musicians now, like young musicians, like I interview a lot of young singer-songwriters who are, like, in their early 20s, and they all love Bruce Springsteen.
Yeah.
You know, they all love Bob Dylan. They continue to draw on that music in the same way that those guys drew on music that was 30 or 40 years before their time. And I think there's a real beauty in that, you know, that we all stand on each other's shoulders and we acknowledge what came before us, but there's a power in sort of taking something that's from tradition and putting your own spin on it and adding to a conversation that extends throughout the ages. You know, and when I listen to music, that's what I hear, and I think that's a really beautiful thing.
I want to talk to you about, in just the minute or two that we have left, some of the new rock and rollers that you like. In your book, you write that the best writer of rock and roll songs on the planet is a funny and keenly observant Australian named Courtney Barnett. So let's listen to a little bit of her. Courtney Barnett there. Stephen Hyden, what do you love about her?
Well, I love that you picked, like, the noisiest song by her, by the way. I should say that she has songs that are, like, much more melodic than that. But, you know, she, you know, look, if you love rock, classic rock because of the lyricism, because of the melodies, because of the personalities, Courtney Barnett has all that in one package. Plus, she has her haircut counts like Keith Richards and Gimme Shelter, and she plays left-handed guitar like Jimi Hendrix and Paul McCartney. So you can kind of see echoes of other rock stars when you see her on stage. But, you know, if she was putting out records in the 70s, we'd be hearing them on classic rock radio today.
Right. So you pose a really interesting question right at the end of the book. You have a sort of subheading that says, how long does classic rock have? And, you know, I take it your conclusion, I mean, you, in a way, you've answered this in many, many different ways, but it lives on in so many ways, right?
Yeah, and, you know, I'm always curious about, like, how these artists will live on after they're gone.
Yes.
You know, we're starting to see hologram tours, you know, happen, where they live on sort of digitally that way. You know, are we going to see more tribute bands? Are we going to see sort of repertory orchestras playing classic rock music in the way that we did the great composers, you know, of centuries past? I'm very curious to see what happens, because, I mean, who knew that the Rolling Stones would still be touring at this age?
Absolutely.
You know, so after they're gone, who's to say what's going to happen? You know, maybe this music will still be on the road. You know, I'm very curious to see what happens.
Well, we'll stay tuned for that. Stephen Hyden, author of Twilight of the Gods, A Journey to the End of Classic Rock. Thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Hey, it was my pleasure.
And let's go out with Led Zeppelin. This is On Point. I'm Anthony Brooks.